Thanks for joining us today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Glad to have you along and glad to have Phil Pelletieri here visiting with us. Phil is an entomologist and heads the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. And it's always a treat to have Phil on to talk about the fascinating world of insects. So thanks for coming by, Phil.
Nice to be here.
So, Phil, there's a lot to talk about, but with the end of the year approaching and the weather slowing down insect activity, I think, at least outdoors, are you in the process of compiling data for the year?
Yeah, I usually tend to have kind of a year-end summary, both because we all have annual reports to do, among other things. But it's just kind of fun to compare year to year. And you know, already I can tell sample-wise I'm above last year, which last year was a pretty buggy year So it's just kind of interesting to see trends, among other things. There's some things, the box elder bugs are down. The Asian lady beetles absolutely fell off the face of the earth, which, you know, those are the ones that like to get into people's homes.
Right.
And that's been kind of an interesting one to watch. And I got in trouble last year when I said this. I had no new state records that I was aware of about this time of the year. And then I had two before we got to the 1st of January.
But I'm never say never.
I'm kind of in that same place so far as nothing, as I said, that I have not seen before other than, you know, sometimes we get repeats. We had a couple brown recluse samples come in, which is kind of an unusual thing.
And those are spiders.
Those are spiders. And they're not established in Wisconsin, but occasionally we do find one in a very isolated place, you know, that is surviving. So.
And I remember every once in a while, I think it was about 15 years ago or so, there was a big scare, kind of people were all paranoid about brown recluse.
And... Well, yeah. I mean, if you go on the internet, you get a lot of information that just terrorizes you. And the reality is that a lot of the things that are reported as recluse bites now turns out to be, we think, MRSA, basically staph infections that present in a very similar manner. And, you know, what got us to that conclusion is that, you know, half the cases were getting diagnosed in states where you couldn't find the spider. That just didn't make sense. And so the same thing is you do hear about people who have had some nasty reactions. They've had to seek medical attention. In whether it's recluse or other ones, sometimes I'm not so sure I would agree with the diagnosis, might be a way of putting it.
Mm-hmm. Now, we actually got an email from Ben saying just what you had just said, an observation this fall, none of those Asian lady beetles. Is there a reason that you're aware of? Why would there be such a precipitous drop?
This has been a trend. And, you know, that's an invasive species that first got in the state in 92. And, you know, a trend that you often see with these critters that don't belong here is this explosion, and then they start to peter out over time. But I think we're all surprised at the sheer drop in numbers. You know, we get a little bit of an inkling on what's going on in the soybean fields because they do feed on soybean aphids. And the soybean aphids were kind of on the light side this year. But a confusion that people get into is they thought that this insect was brought here to control soybean aphid. It was here 10 years or 8 years before soybean aphid even was found in the United States. So it was doing very well without soybean aphid. And so as I said, it is an interesting one. I've seen this trend for about the last 4 or 5 years, but nothing this light.
And what about the Japanese beetles this year?
Well, you know, some of the reports I got, Department of Ag, when they did their year-end summary, they were up in spots. They were down in my yard, you know, compared to, again, where we were sitting 7 or 8 years ago. But the people that they are relatively new for up in the Fox River Valley and whatnot, they had a pretty difficult time. And that, again, is the typical pattern. When they move in, they really start to gain momentum. And I did have some data shared with me from a colleague over in soil science, and he's been keeping traps. And he said his numbers were comparable to what they were 3 years ago, which means he did see an upswing.
Okay. And were there other certain insects that were more active or less active in Wisconsin this year that you're seeing so far?
Well, you know, again, looking at what the Department of Ag, they have a pest survey bulletin that is primarily interested in agricultural pests. And you know, the corn rootworm numbers were up. European corn borer has been in decline for quite some time, and that may be as much a result of so much genetically modified corn being available that it really does keep their populations down. As I said, I saw a lot of sawflies. I mean, every year I come up with a bug of the year, and it's going to be kind of a generic sawfly because I saw species of sawflies that I had not seen before. And again, this is relative. Phil hadn't seen. We had some records of them. There was one on Creeping Jenny, which is a type of loosestrife, and it turns out to be a European species that has been in Canada for quite some time. and all of a sudden decided to have a good spring this year. And as I said, so it's kind of fun at times, as I said, to sit back and look. And I've been doing this for 34 years, and I don't think I've ever seen one year that's lined up the same as a previous year that I've experienced.
So it's hard to just kind of sit back and coast, is what you're saying.
Yeah, and also I've given up making predictions because, boy, oh boy, even when I think I understand what's going on, it turns out I usually don't.
Well, Phil, we have lots more to talk about, but we also have some folks that want to join in the conversation. So let's go to Nan in Mosinee. Hi, Nan.
Hi. Hi, Phil. My question is on a rose. I have quite a few roses, but I only have this problem on the one that's called the fairy. It's a beautiful shrub. It gets small buds on it, but in the 2 years I've had the rose, it's never blossomed because the buds all fall off. They turn yellow and they just fall to the ground.
Okay.
And is something feeding on those tips?
It could be, but you'd have to look close. You know, I have seen a bud moth, a little tiny green caterpillar that burrows into the buds and destroys the flowers. So that would be a possibility. But the only way I would be totally sure is to closely inspect that stem to see if something has been tunneling or mining in there, or if it's just collapsing on its own accord, which would more suggest a disease issue of one sort or another to me. So, you know, the symptom is suspicious, but I can't verify it without. And as I said, these critters aren't overly big, so unless you're looking closely, you'd miss it. But the way I would try to verify it is as the bud is discoloring or whatnot, get out there with a sharp knife and just kind of peel back right at the stem to see if we see any sign of activity in there or discoloration again, which would suggest possibly a disease issue.
And how would I treat that if it's a bug issue?
Well, you know, we really have to know what the critter is.
I see.
But, you know, generally speaking, what happens for a lot of the stuff that affects flowers before they bloom is that's when the application goes on. You're basically killing the weevil or the maggot or whatnot, the fly that's coming in before they get an opportunity to lay eggs.
And would Safer's soap work on that?
Probably not. Safer's is very strong for soft-bodied things, but the kind of critters I would expect it to be shoot borers and whatnot are usually not as near susceptible because they're harder-bodied insects.
And what should I use on that then to treat that if that's what it is?
Well, one of the things, if you're inclined to use chemicals, an interesting one to try, and this would be more of an experiment, but there is a systemic product, the bear tree and shrub insecticide, and they do have a formulation for roses. And the insecticide that's contained in there is very good for aphids. It's very good for a number of things, although if it turns out to be a caterpillar, unfortunately, it would not be. But this is used as a pre-season or early season drench. So you pour it on the roots of the plant, and the plant uptakes it, and then basically anything that's feeding on the plant would be affected. So that would be a product you could consider as far as an experiment. In fact, Bayer is coming out with a new combination product that has two different chemicals in there, and that one would even pick up caterpillars.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks for that call, Nan. And we had an email from Brian in Rochester, Minnesota. He wrote, earlier this year, we heard about the Asian wasp that was being imported to control the emerald ash borer. Did the little critters have the desired effect, or do I have to plan to kiss my healthy 40 mature ash trees goodbye?
Well, it's going to take 3 or 4 years to really get a handle. There were releases of this wasp by my colleague Ken Rafa and his people in the DNR in the Newburgh area. But one of the big questions is, can they survive the winter? And so we'll be seeing next year the results. And that, you know, there has been some encouraging results from what's been going on in Michigan. But we'll have to see. In fact, there was more than one species they're working with. Usually this kind of thing, it does take 2 or 3 years to get enough feel to see, again, are they going to survive? And then the second question is what percentage parasitism? How many emerald ash borers are they killing? So,
and Phil, we often hear about, you know, one insect being introduced to control another and things like that. What's the process of researching who is a good predator for different insects? And, of course, then there's that other thing of, and what are all the possible ways that this can go wrong, which I think has happened, unfortunately,
yes,
more often than
you know,
we'd like.
There are some really tragic stories of things that were introduced back in the 20s, 1920s, 1930s, when I guess we just didn't understand the non-target effects at times. So typically what happens now is you go to the country of origin of your pest. You look at what kind of things naturally can control it, whether it's diseases and parasites and predators and the like. And then you kind of go through a screening. And basically what we've learned biologically, if something's a generalist, it feeds on a wide variety of things, the potential for having non-target effects is very high. And so they are not going to get cleared. But then even if you think you've got through most of the hurdles, there is a rather long process. These things are held in isolation and tested before they finally get the final release from USDA. We've all been awaiting the garlic mustard controlling weevils, and they have been on hold for a while. Things are just not, again, have met all the criteria they want. So as I said, things have gotten a lot better, I think, as far as scientific judgment, as far as what would make a good potential natural control, or, again, are there chances like this Asian lady beetle, which USDA had released numerous times, but never successfully. And then all the evidence points to the introduction was an accidental, probably in the port of New Orleans, probably hitchhiking on a ship, and we've been paying for it ever since.
Mm-hmm. And certainly you see those accidental releases in fish and mussels and all kinds of things.
Yes,
so.
And, you know, I the track record is not overly good when you look at it. I mean, we get so excited about successes. I always tell my students, you know, our success rate in the insect world of introducing things to control pests is really less than 10%.
Wow.
You know, and we've had some stunning successes, but as I said, it's a much more complicated story than it might appear.
Well, and it sounds like now maybe the precautionary principle is being used a little more to...
Oh, very much
to,
so. Very
you know,
much
unless
so.
It's sure that there aren't negatives not doing it instead of doing it and hoping for
right.
the pests.
So, right.
Yeah. Phil Pelletieri, entomologist and head of the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, is our guest today, and you can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. Chris Molina is our on-air producer today. He will get your phone calls and emails into us. And if you have a bug that you would like Phil to ID, if you have a photo, put it up on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mealer Show. And Mealer is spelled M-E-I-L-L-E-R. Sometimes people have a hard time with that one. So feel free to put it up there and Phil will take a look and hopefully be able to tell you what insect you're dealing with. We'll be back in just a second. Talking insects with entomologist Phil Pelletieri and welcoming your calls and emails, 1-800-642-1234 or talk@wpr.org. Phil, a lot of folks travel over the holidays and over school holidays towards the end of the year. And what's been going on with the bed bug infestation that's affected other parts of the country? Have we been invaded yet?
Oh, no. Every place has been invaded. And, you know, I would say the hotel industry has gone to really great extremes trying to lessen because the problem that they have is they always are potentially introduced. And, you know, a lot of the bigger chains have went to bed bug sniffing dogs and other ways of trying to catch this very early so it doesn't spread throughout. But you still have to keep your guard up. And so, you know, it's good to be familiar with what you're looking for, the little black spots, waste spots on the headboards and the like. It is just reasonable to pull a sheet back and look along the mattress seam. A good precaution, I think, is to store your luggage in the bathtub, because that's a place you don't expect them. Because I think aside from the personal assault, if you're unfortunate enough to be fed on, the other problem with bed bugs is the potential of bringing them home and then the difficulty of dealing with them there. You know, it has to be pointed out, a third of us don't respond to the bites. And then it is not unusual for the bites to take as long as 48 hours to present. So sometimes you wake up the next morning with bites, you think you've had bed bugs. Do you have to think what you've been doing the last 2 or 3 days?
Kind of like food poisoning.
Yes. Well, even though one case, it's really intriguing of a woman who allowed bed bugs to feed on a person, didn't respond and whatnot. And lo and behold, 2 weeks later, every place a bed bug had fed, she had a spot. It took that long to see
wow.
a response. And so they said there's some pretty strange things going. But in general, as I said, people have been very, very proactive trying to stop this as best they can. And so, you know, I do have people call me up that are just terrorized by the thought of traveling. But the probability of seeing a bed bug infestation, I think still is around 1% to a little bit less in hotel rooms in the U.S.
Oh, that's good to hear. Actually, Travis had some comments on the Facebook page about his travel protocol for avoiding bed bugs. He is checking the bed bug registry to try to find hotels that did not have recent bed bug reports. He says day before the trip, spray the inside of the car and all luggage prior to packing with a professional grade area flea spray.
Yeah, I would really hesitate to do that because most likely they're going to be resistant to it anyway.
Ah.
You know, so
and that's a lot of chemicals.
Yeah,
and on your own stuff.
You know, for people who travel a lot, one of the options, they do have a suitcase heater. So you bring your suitcase in and you basically zip it up and turn it up and you cook them out. And so, you know, they run about $300. But again, if you travel for a living, that may be a great precaution to introduce them and a much cheaper than a bed bug treatment going on. You know, another thought is to bring a garbage bag and wrap all your stuff in a garbage bag so you have that physical barriers. Because what you worry most about is them crawling into seams of things and the like. And, you know, sometimes if people have a big enough freezer, you can throw your suitcase in a freezer for 4 or 5 days. Although cold is tricky because the only temperature I know that kills them immediately is about minus 15, which is much colder than most of our freezers.
Right.
And so sometimes people give cold too much credit, but it does have some possible uses.
And then Travis also says not taking things home from the hotel and like you said, isolating the luggage. So some good ideas, but probably don't want to get too carried away with the chemicals.
Yeah, I mean, there are some contact sprays. You will find products that have isopropyl alcohol and cedar oil and other things. And I guess that's the other question that we suggest that people investigate. There's a lot of things that are making great claims on bed bugs, and there's a lot of things that will kill them on contact. But what we really would need is something that has some residual that would last for a few days because it would be much more effective. And that's where we're really seeing the problems is that the longer residual insecticides, there's an awful lot of resistance in the bed bug population.
And what's the cycle of a bed bug? Like, you know, if you kill adults on contact, are there potentially larvae also and things like that?
Well, they have, you know, the nymphs are active feeders. The problem is if the adults have laid eggs, that those will hatch in a period of 7 to 10 days. Now, you know, females only lay 4 or 5 eggs a day at best. And, you know, she has to be mature. Immature bed bugs can't lay eggs. And so, you know, there is not, not every bed bug is potentially going to end up in causing an infestation. But the problem, though, is because they're so good at sneaking into things, there are places where you can't get the spray contact. And so, as I said, if they're out in the open, they're easy to kill. You could probably even kill them with a lot of the indoor house cleaners. You know, they have components that would work. The problem is having something that will last long enough that if the bed bug crawls on it 2 days later, that it will be effective in killing them.
Great. Thanks for that update. And let's go back to the phones. Phil in Hebron, Illinois wants to talk to Phil here in the studio. Hi, Phil.
Hi, good morning. I have a quick question for you, Phil. We've been tucking our honeybees away and making sure they have plenty of stores so they come through in the spring. And every March when we open our hives up, get that nice smell of the comb and what's left of the honey, your happy little bumblebees show up. And my question is, what are they eating all winter? And I know they don't cluster to stay nice and warm and make it through the winter. So can they slow their metabolism down like a bear, or how do they do it?
Well, you know, what you're dealing with everything other than honeybees, is the first bees that you see in the spring are overwintering queens that have really gone through a hibernation state, where they hide under a rock or some protected place. And then in the spring, when they wake up, they need to find a nesting site. And in the case of bumblebees, it's usually, you know, an old gopher burrow or something. But then they're looking for honey, or at least if they can rob some honey, as a quick energy source to kind of get the body going again. So that's the unique thing about honeybees. It's the only colony-forming bee that we have in the United States that overwinters as a colony and you know, generates its own heat and whatnot to be able to survive, whereas everybody else is basically going through, we don't call it hibernation, we call it diapause, which is basically an insect form of hibernation where things are basically in a frozen, isolated, almost stupor, and then again in the spring revive and they're off and running.
All right, thanks for that call. And let's go to Ron in Milwaukee next. Hi, Ron.
Hi, you were speaking of getting cold and whatever. My daughter-in-law was talking about the woolly bear caterpillars. First of all, do they inhabit all of Wisconsin? That would, and are they and have they been any kind of indicator of upcoming winter condition.
Sure. Well, you know, the infamous one is the banded woolly bear, which is kind of a reddish brown in the middle and black on the ends. The tradition tells us that the wider the red band is, the warmer the winter. There's no scientific truth to it, but it's fun to play around with. Now, we have other species of woolly bears, and this is one of the things that will really confuse you. We've got total black ones. We've got total red ones. We got yellowish ones. So there's a number of different species, and they all belong to a group we call tiger moths, and their strategy is to spend the winter as full-grown caterpillars, hiding in some sheltered sites. They don't spin their cocoons down till the following spring. So anybody who brings a woolly bear into the house thinking it's going to do it a favor, honestly, is going the wrong direction, because first of all, it doesn't get the cold shock it needs to develop properly. Secondly, at the warmer temperatures of the house, it will be burning its energy stores that much quicker than it would outdoors. And so usually they don't make it if you think you're helping them, but they're not. And now, on the other hand, I'm asked every year what the woolly bears tell me, and I will tell you I tend to lean on the warm side, because I found if people like to hear that, I like to think the idea. And you know, generally speaking, compared to the winters I put up with growing up in a kid here, it has been warmer, per se. If you tell people it's going to be a colder winter, they're a little upset about that. And I find people don't remember anyway. So, you know, it's best to kind of set them off on a good thing. But it's fun to play with. And I will tell you truthfully, the first woolly bear I saw this year had an extended band that probably accounted for about 65% of its body. And that would suggest a warm winter. So we'll see where it goes.
So we really don't even need to get those big winter coats out, is what you're saying.
Well, maybe not quite that much now. You know, relatively speaking, you know, as we've talked about on the show before, it has been interesting to watch insect-wise in the last 15 years or so, things that were basically southern insects move into the state. And it's been the lack of cold weather. And you know, by cold, I'm talking 25 below, 30 below, that we've lost some of those killing temperatures, and that's allowed things to extend their range northward. And that's been a trend that I have seen easily in the last 15 to 20 years.
Mm. Great. Thanks for that call, Ron. And let's go to Daryl in Fairchild next. Hi, Daryl.
Yes, hello. Say, Phil, I took out an oak tree here a while back for some firewood, and the rotten section contains some white thumb-sized grubs. I'm wondering what they are. Are they what they're the larva of? Mm-hmm. Will they survive outside their little rotten section inside the tree? What are they?
It's one of two things, and they look almost identical. The grubs are in the scarab beetle family, and there is a common one called a leather beetle. The genus is Osmoderma, where the grubs are typically found in decaying wood. In a related family, the stag beetles, and some people even think stag beetles are a type of scarab beetle. The stag beetles of Wisconsin are found in the same environment, look almost identical. They're really very difficult to tell apart. They will survive if you take some of that rotten wood and put it in a jar and keep it just a little bit moist. They will continue to develop, whether you put that out in the garage or you leave it in a warm area. But outside of that environment, without the decaying wood to feed on and then also the moisture that they need to kind of maintain themselves, they won't live very long.
They develop into beetles.
Yeah, beetles, and it's either going to be the stag beetle, Pseudolucanus is the genus that we've got up here, or something called a leather beetle, which looks like a very large June beetle, a little bit more flattened, a little dark, almost a dark brownish black in color. And big. I'm talking about the size of a 50-cent piece, and so they get pretty big. They, in both cases, they pupate inside this little chamber that will remind you almost of the center of a walnut. They kind of spin this down, construct this, and then that's what they use to transform into the beetle stage from the grub.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Well, and also, Daryl, when those beetles do develop, take a picture and send it in to us.
That would be great. I did save them. I thought I was maybe use them for fish food, but they sink so fast. I don't know if in the pond, I don't know if the fish eat them or they just...
Oh, yeah. They would make, if you can keep them on, and you know, because, again, the grubs do get very large in size, so you're going after bigger fish. This is something a little panfish is not going to be able to handle.
Yes, you bet.
All right. Well, thanks so much for that call, Daryl. And let's go right to Jim in Fond du Lac next. Hi, Jim.
Hello. This is just for curiosity's sake, but I was up deer hunting in Forest County up near the Michigan border, and Saturday when it was raining and snowing and sleeting, in my blind, I still had little about mosquito size like lace wings flying. I'm curious, how cold does it have to be before we don't have any bugs flying around yet?
Well, typically, you know, when you talk about insect metabolism and being cold-blooded, if the temperature is really much below 50 degrees, they've got problems. A couple tricks that insects will use. On sunny days, dark-bodied insects can sit and basically absorb heat from the sun. But the other trick that goes on is once an insect gets to a point that it can start moving its muscles, as we know, when we exercise a lot, we generate heat. So insects are capable of getting their body temperature up above the outside air temperature. And what happens, you know, what I noticed in the deer stand, and it was a little warmer down here than it was up there, but as things warmed up in the low 40s, I was seeing moths flying. And there is a group that we call winter moths that are active in the very late fall. You know, real windy days, I mean, there's certain conditions that would rob their heat so quickly that they wouldn't be able to be active. So generally, as I said, speaking below 50 degrees, things tend to get in trouble. But I have seen some interesting things even at 35 degrees. But there are some tricks the insects are using. We often consider the insect season done after three hard freezes. But if you get down in the leaf litter and whatnot and warm it up a little bit, there are critters that will become active really quite quickly. So I wonder in the deer blind if you might have been generating enough heat that, again, stuff was coming out from below just because it was getting warm enough that they could make that critical temperature.
Yeah, this was a little like a diaphanous, tiny lace wing type, Tinkerbell wings on it type of fly.
Interesting.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much for calling, Jim. And if you have a question for Phil Pelletieri, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email at talk@wpr.org. And Phil, we had some comments and questions on the Facebook page. One from Tad is, can you explain the life cycle of deer ticks? They seem to have two seasons when they are active, spring and fall. Is one season breeding and the other nymphs? And just what do they need all that blood for?
Okay, well, it's a little more complicated. The life cycle is 2 years long. And if we start in the spring with adults, they're looking for a blood meal. The females in particular are the ones that feed the longest because the protein that they get from the blood, they will convert to about 2,000 eggs. They hatch into a little tiny stage called the larva, which typically doesn't feed on humans, feeds on mice. Larvae are often quite active in the spring and in through the summer. Once the larvae has fed once, they drop off the host, they molt, and they transform into what we call the nymph stage. The nymph stage is an active feeder both on humans and rodents and dogs and whatever, so they're kind of a generalist. The nymphs are most active late summer into early fall, and if the nymph was successful in feeding, they would also convert to the adult. I start seeing the new adults about the 15th of October, so that's the fall explanation, and the ones that don't feed are the ones that are out there in the spring again to continue on. Even though most of us recognize the adult ticks in the spring and fall, the tick season as far as ones that would feed on humans is all anytime there's no snow on the ground. And in particular, we know because the nymphs are smaller, they're more easily overlooked. And it's interesting when you see the onset of human disease, we know that the nymphs are transmitting more disease than the adults, probably because they're overlooked. Whereas many of the adults are removed before they have the opportunity to transmit the disease. So, even now, you know, at least in the southern part of the state, there's no snow on the ground. And I don't think the tick season's over until the snow is there. So you do have to be cautious when you're crawling around in the woods because it wouldn't be that unusual to pick up a tick. As they said, if the temperature, and it's kind of the same thing as we talked about before. I mean, if it's 20 degrees out, the ticks just can't move their bodies. But if they're on a southern slope and they get a good sun and whatnot, and it might only be 42 degrees air temperature, they could become active.
Well, and for instance, I think the forecast for tomorrow here in Madison is actually in the low 50s. So
right. That's... And I surprised, there was 1 year that I received a tick sample, a deer tick sample from Spooner, Wisconsin in January. It was a young person had picked it up in the school forest. They went out for a walk, but the same thing. If you looked at the temperature records, we had 50 degrees. It was one of those crazy Januaries and whatnot, and it must have melted the snow enough, or there was an area there was no snow, and the ticks became active.
Let's go to Janet in Madison next. Hi, Janet.
Hi. I have a question about katydids, or actually I have several questions, and I'd love to know whatever you know about katydids. In the summer, I've really enjoyed them, and I've noticed a couple things. One is it seems that they seem to be in clusters. I live on the west side of Madison, and there's maybe four or five clusters so to speak, that I'm aware of, where I'm on a walk or driving, and I'll hear the katydids chirping away, and then you pass that block, and it's quiet. And there's another part of town where I can find another batch of them. So I'm curious, what makes them cluster? Is it a certain kind of tree? Why are they not spread out more? Also, as the temperatures got colder, I noticed that their chirps got slower. And so I'm wondering if that's true and what their threshold is before they stop altogether, which leads to my last question. What happens to them over the winter? Do they go dormant? Do they die?
Sure.
Migrate.
So katydid is kind of a generic term, but it does refer to a family of what we call long-horned grasshoppers, or the tetagoniids. And we're limited to about three or four common species of katydids in Wisconsin. There are far more in southern states, and they each have kind of unique calls. One generation a year, the strategy is to spend the winter in the egg form. And those eggs hatch in the spring, and then it takes a good part of the year for them to develop. And they don't start making noise till they become adults. And what you are hearing are generally the males, which are both advertising for a female, but they're also somewhat territorial. So yeah, as you probably noticed, you'll get the two kind of calling back and forth, two males, and they're in two different trees. They might be adjacent trees, but you rarely expect to find two of them in the same tree. They're just not really tolerant of that, and they'll probably go and wrestle with each other until we have a winner and loser there. And the call is influenced. I mean, everything insects do is temperature influence. So the warmer it is, the shorter the call cycle, and the more, and you get down to, as I said, that kind of 50, 55 degrees, and it's just hard to get the muscles working and things don't work quite so well. So you do see a slowing down. So, you know, they're definitely the noisiest on a nice, humid 85-degree night type of thing. And, you know, these longhorn grasshoppers typically are green in color, so they're rather well camouflaged. The females of many of the species have a relatively long sword-like device, which is their egg-laying device, which allows them to inject these eggs into plant tissues and other things, or in some cases into the ground, which is a strategy they like to use. Interesting enough, though, there are pink forms and brown forms, depending on the species. And the pink ones look so unnatural. I haven't seen many in my career, but I have seen a couple, three. And as I said, if you investigate katydids, pink katydids on the internet, I'm sure you'll get some great pictures, and they just look like the strangest beast. Hmm. Same species, so it's, you know, genetically determined. But why you would want to have a pink form, I haven't quite, that one's deeper than Phil. I haven't figured out what the strategy would be there. But so they are fun. And I have noticed in Madison in particular, the corner of Sego in Whitney Way, every year, if you want to get a chorus for whatever reason, and you know, these things can get loud enough that honestly, if you got your window open and you live next door to it, it may be a little difficult to get to sleep. And,
wow.
Where in my neighborhood, it's kind of an on again, off again. You know, some years there'll be some around, some years there won't. So I really don't know if we totally understand, but you generally need a lot of shrubs and bushes and trees type of thing as the environment. Although there are some species of katydids that are associated with prairies, and you can find that too. But I'm trying to remember the Night Songs of Insects. It was a book that came out about 5 or 6 years ago. Just an exquisite book, both in its photography, but they also have a CD associated with it that have the calls of all of these katydids and crickets and everything else that makes sounds in the insect world. And so it's a very reasonable book, so it's something to look for in the bookstore if you want to get some more background information. And even they've got range maps of all the species and the like. So that's
and what's the name of that again?
I think it's Night Songs of Insects, if I remember correctly.
That sounds great.
In fact, Larry had the authors on the show a couple, 3 years ago, shortly after the book had come out.
Why am I not surprised? Great. Well, thanks for that call, Janet. And let's go to David in South Milwaukee, who has a follow-up bedbug question. Hi, David.
Interesting program to have when everybody's preparing meals here.
we try for the best lunchtime topics.
I have three questions about bedbugs, if I could. I live in a three flat, and if the apartment downstairs or next door gets bed bugs, am I doomed to get them? And secondly, has anybody explored something like a roach motel for bed bugs, in which they find something they're attracted to and they go to that trap instead of going, you know, to the person in bed. And finally, and I know they feed on blood, what if one were to put a piece of liver by the bed? Would they go for the liver? Because that's much easier than having to jab a person's skin.
Okay. The first one, liver, probably not, because it doesn't generate the kind of heat that they would be interested in, and probably doesn't give off the carbon dioxide they need. I mean, that's what we're finding with bed bugs. They do respond to carbon dioxide. And there are various traps out there that are used more as a monitoring trap. I've never seen these things be so effective that you could use it as a control method. And even as a monitoring trap, they're kind of iffy. One of the inexpensive versions of this is just getting some dry ice and putting it in an insulated cup. So people have looked at it, in particular, as I said, trying to catch bed bugs when they're early in low populations, and we haven't cracked that one yet. As I said, it's more complicated, and definitely, as I said, I doubt we'll ever come up with a trap that is so good that can be our control strategy by itself. Now, the question when you do live in multifamily housing, the probability if your neighbors get infested and you live up or down from them, it's 60%, and if you're adjacent, it's 40%. Now, you know, part of this factor is how many bed bugs are there and whatnot, but they do seem to pick up and move, a lot like cockroaches, that over time, if not dealt with, yes, we do expect them to spread. And that's why it's important in apartments that every unit is inspected, or at least the adjacent units to one that you know it's infested. And what gets difficult is low numbers are hard to detect. And that's why, again, companies have gone to these bed bug sniffing dogs, which are far more efficient. But it's not inexpensive. I mean, to rent a dog runs $300 an hour, you know, and you can see again why the hotels find that is a very convenient way. But for a 3 or 4 unit apartment to bring a dog in, you have to seriously consider, is there a reason why we should? Now, on the other hand, when you look at the cost of the dog versus the cost of the treatment, the dog is less expensive. So there are times where the dog would really be very fitting, I think. But you have to realize, as they said, that the dogs do have quite an expense when you bring them in and the like.
Well, and the dog is detecting it. So if the dog detects it, you'd still need to do the treatment.
Yes,
so,
right.
So are there particular kinds of dogs that are good bed bug sniffers? Is it the same kinds of dogs that they use for, say, drug enforcement?
Yes, same type of thing. Although a lot of beagles, it seems like. Although the original bed bug dog was this just little funny-looking critter that, you know, a lot of this work was done down in Florida originally. And Phil Kohler, who's an urban entomologist down there, has done a lot of work with bed bugs in general. And as I said, and one of the things that's going on now is trying to come up with some kind of certification process so that we have some kind of level. Because there have been some disappointing stories where dogs gave false positives, people spent an awful lot of money. So as I said, you need some quality control, like in other things here, to expect that the dog is giving you the right message.
I keep getting this funny mental image of a dog sniffing for bed bugs and ending up inhaling a few in the process because they're pretty small. And so
yeah, but
they stick tight.
They stick tight. So, you know, that's not going to be. But it is interesting to see, you know, I've witnessed examples of bed bug sniffing dogs where they've hid bed bugs on the top of a planter or something, and it's just amazing to see how efficient the
dogs are. That's amazing. Wow, that would be really interesting to see. Thanks for that call, David. And let's go to Anne Marie in Milwaukee. Hi, Anne Marie.
Hi there. Thank you. I'm just curious about a problem I had over the summer. Are you there?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I live in a threeplex. And I've lived here about 12 years, and just this last summer, I had, I don't know if infestation is the right word or not, but I had big ants, real dark black ants, and it really kind of... I didn't like them. And so for the first time, I went out and bought those little white discs. I had like 4 of them. I put, you know, in the kitchen and the bedroom. And that did seem to help. And now they're gone. I assume it's because of the weather. But why did I all of a sudden see them last summer? And I've never seen them before. I mean, nothing here has changed.
Yeah, well, the thing about ants, and it gets complicated because there's numerous different species and different reasons, but how I could explain what happened to you is that it suggests the pattern is that you had outside ants coming in for food. And it could have been something as simple as somebody spilling a little orange juice and just forgetting to wipe it up properly. And it's true that when an ant finds a food source, it can communicate to other ants that there's free food. And so you can get this explosion in a very short period of time, usually in the kitchen. I mean, that's or, you know, if you've got a pet and there's a dog food dish somewhere, you know, so that's a constant source of food. The ants find it. All of a sudden, I got ants crawling everywhere. When we get to this time of the year, because all the outside ants are basically dormant, when we see ants, one of the things that tells us right away is the ants are living indoors. You know, and there are certain species. Carpenter ants, pavement ants, odorous house ants are examples of species that will on times. And so when that's one of the first questions when I'm talking to people about ants, if they don't have a specimen to show me, is what's the pattern? When did you see them? What are they doing and whatnot? Because we're trying to decide, is it outside ants just wandering in for food, which is nothing more than a nuisance? Or are they nesting indoors? And it's still probably just a nuisance, but something that you want to address because they aren't going to go away. And I'm not sure if your ant traps worked or not. Different species of ants require different kinds of baits, and you have to match them properly. In general, baits they're a great way to control ants, but they take time. Sometimes it's just an artifact. If it was a food issue and the food's gone, the ants stop coming in. You know, it looks like the traps have been working, and it has really nothing to do with it. So, you know, it's encouraging they went away. As I said, you may have just drawn some in. I've seen the same thing. I remember we took the kids camping when they were small one time, and we came home and I opened up the kitchen closet where we kept our garbage, and there must have been 300 carpenter ants running around just everywhere. And, you know, we had left a small amount of food in the garbage, and lo and behold, they found it, and they were taking advantage.
And going back to how the traps work, Phil, it's my understanding, and I could very well be wrong, that what you want is for the ants to take what's in the trap and take it back to wherever all the other ants are.
Right. And what you try to match is some ants have a sweet tooth, so you have sugar baits. Some are protein feeders, so you need some kind of fat or protein as a base. Some of the baits have both, but it's very hard to come up with one ant trap that's going to cover all the bases. And honestly, I've got a couple species of ants that it's not even worth trying to trap because it doesn't work. They just don't have baits that they respond to. So I know I frustrate people when they say, I got ants, what to do? And I usually say, please send me some ants, because if I know it's pavement ant, then I know which direction to go in the like. And there's at least a dozen different species of ants that you could potentially expect to find in your house in Wisconsin.
And I have to say, going back to the pet food, unbelievable how those ants could figure out we would put the cat food bowl down, you know, at various points during the day. So there wouldn't be anything there for hours. We would put the bowl down, turn around. I swear, 30 seconds later, there's this little row of ants. It's like, you know, the signal went out, you know, lunchtime. And it was amazing how they would just show up as soon as it was down on the floor.
I used to think of all the old cartoons they used to have, the picnic
yes.
ants.
But yes.
That, honestly, it, you know, with the ant whistling for the other, it really biologically isn't a whole lot different than that.
Well, thanks for that call, Anne-Marie. And I want to let people know that if they want to talk with entomologist Phil Pelletieri, you can do that by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. Stay tuned. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, talking with Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, insect guru, and head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. And Phil, we've got some great photos up on the Facebook page, and you can all see those, whether you're on Facebook as a user or not. You can always look at what's on our show's page, and it's The Larry Mueller Show, MEILLER on Facebook. You can just Google Facebook Larry Mueller Show and it'll pop up. Brian put up an amazing photo of, what is it?
A white marked tussock moth caterpillar.
White marked tussock moth caterpillar.
You will sometimes see it referenced as a yellow marked tussock moth caterpillar. And what they're referring to is those tufts in back of the head. But this thing kind of looks like an alien because
it's got
all kinds of interesting hairs and the like.
Yeah. It's got long hair. It's got four little, as you said, tufts sticking up It's got red on the back end. It looks like a fishing
lure. That's
the
front end.
That's front end. So sorry. My apologies to the tussock moth caterpillar. But it's hard to tell, isn't it? Well, at least for me it is. But I mean, it looks like a fishing lure or something. There's so much going on.
And they get about 2 inches long. And great photographic subjects. And they feed on apple trees, but a lot of other different things. Maples is another plant that you can see tussock moths on. And an interesting group because the caterpillar spins a cocoon, and the female moth is flightless, and the males have to come in and visit, and then she'll lay her eggs inside that cocoon case, and very reminiscent of gypsy moths. In fact, they can be mistaken for gypsy moths if you're not used to looking at the egg masses, and the same thing, they get through the winter as eggs, so it is something that we run into, but rarely are they much of a problem. They're under natural control 98% of the time.
And are they all over Wisconsin or
yes,
certain parts?
Yes, you can find tussock moths anywhere.
Wow, it's really beautiful. I would really recommend people going to the Facebook page to see that. And then Marilyn has a picture of an insect that she found on her lawn furniture, and it looks like a little stick.
Well, in reality, it looks like a cigar if you were to
it.
And it turns out that this is a chamber from some species of leafcutter bee. And what the leafcutter bees will use is basically straw-like habitats. They go out and cut foliage, and you'll see this sometimes on your rose bushes, this little round hole cut out of the leaf, and very round. I mean, it's amazing. And they use this basically to partition and decide, and then they'll get a bunch of pollen. They'll put it in there, lay their egg, and then there's a chamber. So I'm guessing there's 4 or 5 chambers inside the cigar-like structure. And then, interesting enough, next spring, the bees will come out, and you have to do it in reverse order because the first one that's laid has to be the last one out, versus the last one, which is at the tip, has to be the first one out. And this, you know, fits for orchard mason bees and a lot of these native pollinators that we're trying to promote. If you understand, what we're providing here is the habitat. In different diameter straw-like devices will support different species of bees. And so this is really a beneficial thing. The other place I get people sending these is sometimes in window designs, the ventilation holes and whatnot are just the right diameter and whatnot that we get the leafcutter bees getting up in there. There's also some predaceous wasps that do similar things. So instead of pollen, we would find their prey, you know, crickets, other things inside these chambers. But it's usually one or the other, the bees or the wasp. And I could tell from this one, it's one of the leafcutter bees.
And so what should Marilyn do with this? She found this on her lawn furniture. What should she do to help the bees?
Well, probably put it in a container and probably leave it out in the garage. I mean, I'm a little concerned about mice getting access to it because it's a great protein source, so they can get to it. Leave it in that somewhat sheltered site till next spring. And honestly, then you could probably open the container, and when the bees decide to emerge, they will go off and flying. Most of these have one generation a year. Some of them only are active as an adult for a couple, 3 weeks, and then they spend basically the rest of their time developing in these structures.
Wow. Well, thanks for that picture, Marilyn. That's really interesting. And then a listener, Savannah, found a spider at home and is hoping for an identification, but it's the spider is dark and is on a dark background. And Phil, you were saying it's a little hard to zero in
on there. Yeah, I really can't. You know, that one might be worth sending to me. And see if I can doctor the photo a little bit and lighten it up.
We can do that.
Because then I might be able to pick up. I mean, I just can't even see the legs well enough to give you a real reasonable guess.
Okay. Well, we will definitely get that to you, and we'll try to let Savannah know after. So let's go to Janice in Cross Plains next. Hi, Janice.
Hi.
What's your question?
How are you?
Good.
Good. Well, I'm calling with a problem that we have this fall, and I know it was addressed in one of your earlier programs, and it was the millipedes. Unlike most people in Cross Plains, we had a huge infestation. We had a back pond that was actually just almost filled with millipedes. We actually had to have it drained and cleaned because it got so deep with these bugs. Our garage was like walking on Rice Krispies, and when our son blew the leaves out of our eaves trough, they were piled up on our roof also. So it was huge, and I remember weeding, and it was kind of like the ground was moving when I was, you know, weeding around the house. So is there anything we can do to be a little more proactive? You know, a few of them I don't mind, but...
Yeah. what makes this frustrating, and we had a very interesting year. We had this explosion in the middle of the summer, which is somewhat unusual. I'm more used to millipede invasions in the fall. And the only thing I can equate this to is the lushness of last year. We had, you know, tremendous rainfall, tremendous plant growth, which was great for our trees and such. But that means we had a lot of organic matter, and that's what fuels the millipedes. And what makes life miserable here is, my guess is that your invasion could probably have come from off your property. And that's the thing is, millipedes can go 200, 300 yards, and they go through this wanderlust phase where they're just out cruising at night. And then when the sun comes up, they're going to accumulate where it's cool, damp, and dark. And whether that's on your garage floor or crawling up and falling into the eaves. And so you really don't have control. You know, and I tease people, you know, if your whole yard was a sandbox, there'd be no organic matter, there'd be no millipedes. But, you know, the normal things we do to have a garden and the like, and having mulch around, it does support millipedes to some degree, but not these kind of numbers. As I said, what I'm guessing is somewhere close by, you've got prairie, you've got, you know, maybe it's the swamp itself, if that's close by, or even woodlots that have 5 or 6 inches of leaf litter. There's a tremendous amount of organic matter, and the millipedes can go from there. And then they, as I said, travel a far enough distance. So making things drier, making things sunny and whatnot helps somewhat, but you're somewhat limited in what you can do with that. And the only thing I can say that might help a little bit is they can't get any worse than this. I never see them consistently be this bad year after year after year, unless we have some very specialized situations. And so, you know, one would guess, and especially because we had a more of a dry spell in the southern part of the state in late summer, I would think that would end up with giving us less millipedes next year.
That would be good.
Yeah, I'm sure you took great comfort in that it can't get any worse than that.
Yes.
Wow. Well, you know, Janice, the other thing is, if it is that bad again, charge admission to come see it, because I have to say that sounded pretty amazing in not a very appetizing way.
No, it was not. Thank you.
People tease me about when I embellish things, but it's like a science fiction movie. If you have not seen them, and we did have people sending us pictures of them 4 or 5 inches deep on the side of their house.
You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Please stay tuned. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. So happy to have you along on the Ideas Network. The changes in temperatures and length of days mean lots of insect activity, both indoors and outside. But sometimes it's hard to know what's cause for concern and what's just an inconvenience. We're lucky to have entomologist Phil Pelletieri here for the next half hour to talk about the fascinating world of insects. Phil's the director of the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. He's got lots of great information to share, and he'll answer your questions, too. Is there an insect you want to know more about? Wondering what pests may affect Wisconsin next year? Join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. You can also send us an email at talk@wpr.org. And don't forget to check our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show, to post your comments and photos. Like the page while you're there to get updates on upcoming show topics. There's so much to talk about with Phil. I hope you'll stay tuned. We'll be right back after this look at the news. Welcome back to The Larry Mueller Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, happily sitting in for Larry today with Phil Pelletieri, entomologist and head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. And Phil, we have several people that have been waiting oh so patiently to talk with you, so let's go right to the phone. Mary in Delafield's next. Hi, Mary.
Hi, I hope I'm the right Mary. I have a question. Many years ago, we found two small, what appeared to be ladybird beetles, eating our morning glories. But the odd thing was, besides the fact that they were eating vegetables, is they turned a very, very shiny metallic gold at times, and then they would turn back to their normal color. And I've always wondered what they were.
Well, and okay. Phil's nodding his head, so I think he might know.
So it looks like a lady beetle, but it's not. It turns out to be something we call a tortoise beetle, which is in the leaf beetle family. And there is one species that is bright gold when it's happy, and it will evolve into kind of a burnt orange when it's not.
So it's a mood ring.
Well, no, it really isn't. And it's a metabolic color, and so when they're dead, they're all burnt orange. And morning glory is one of the host plants. There are some other tortoise beetles you occasionally see on potatoes. There's about 4 species in the state. It's a big group in the tropics, and they, again, generally speaking, are very impressive photographic subjects. So they have bright colors. We have another one that has a silver streaks in it. Same thing, and you disturb it, and the colors tend to fade a bit. But you had one of the species of tortoise beetles, and their plant feeders were, in general, all but everything other than Mexican bean beetle here in the lady beetle family are predators on other insects.
Oh, and it was beautiful. And, you know, being happy was right because there were two of them, and it tended to be while they were mating that they turned gold. But the other question is, in the spring when I plant, and the children in my class, who love bugs, by the way, they're always putting them under the microscope, when we plant our sunflowers, something takes one bite and just leaves the leaves lay and doesn't eat it. Is that an insect or a rabbit?
I would think the rabbit would keep feeding. I mean, that kind of damage, that we have cutworms, which are a type of caterpillar, and they do most of their feeding at night, and that's kind of what you see is they bite in, although sometimes they'll pull the plant down. But I would wonder if you've had some cutworm activity in numerous species, so there's always potentially some out there.
Thanks for that call, Mary. And let's go to Scott in Madison next. Hi, Scott.
Hi. Hey, I'm actually from Minneapolis, but I'm traveling through Wisconsin today, and a great show. I have a question for you. I originally grew up in southern Missouri, and at an early age, I was taught to recognize, actually, my question is in regard to spiders, not bugs, but at an early age, I was taught to recognize the brown recluse and the black widow, and I've only ever seen a couple of black widows, but I've seen plenty of brown recluses, and I hate those things. But thankfully, I've never been bit. So my question for you is there any risk of either of those two bad boys moving north, either due to climate change or just on the move? Or are they already here? Is this part of their natural range?
Sure. We do have a northern widow that's in the black widow group. It is a very uncommon spider. I have never talked to anybody that's been bit by one. And so they're already here, but they're few and far between. It's interesting with recluse because the normal range we think is about central Illinois. And although I have about six sites in the state where I know we've had breeding populations, when we talk to Rick Vetter, who is probably the expert with recluse in the United States, he doesn't think there's evidence of them expanding their range, that these are just kind of outliers. And the interesting question is why. And I don't think we really understand because you figure, you know, the indoors, it's warm enough, there's food. Why don't they take hold? There's something we don't understand about their biology that is lacking here. And again, this may be less likely to be climate change induced because they are occasionally an indoor spider. They have unlimited reasonable climate with human habitation, and they just don't take hold. And so it's an interesting one to watch. And it's really intriguing when I bump into them. As I said, I had two samples of recluse this late summer in the Madison area, two separate sites, known breeding populations from the way they're acting. But then I'll go 3 or 4 years and not see one. So
nothing immediately on the horizon.
No.
All right. Thanks for that call, Scott. And let's go to Judy in Platteville. Hi, Judy. Judy? All right. Let's try Lucille in Green Bay. Hi, Lucille.
Hi. How are you doing?
Good.
That's good. I have a comment and then I have a question.
All right.
I'm going to ask my question first. When I find caterpillars in my basement, should I leave them down there or should I take them and throw them outside?
I would take them outside because, again, typically the caterpillars we find in the fall are ones that need a cold shock for them to develop properly.
Okay, I see a lot of them sometimes. Anyways, my next comment is on the ant thing. I lived in Oklahoma for about 10 years. And I got in my garden some of these fire ants where they bit me in the foot, and my foot felt like it was burning up. Anyways, what I did was an old family recipe from way back, grandma and grandpa type thing, farina or cream of wheat. I found their mound. I sprinkled it all over the mound, and in about 3 days' time, they were all gone. They take those little granules, and they eat them, and they carry them into their nest to their queen or whatever you might call it, and as their body fluids, the granules expand, they pop and they die.
Well, let's see what Phil thinks of that. Phil,
I've heard this a number of times, and be honest, it's never scientifically been able to reproduce it. And, you know, I've heard other things that you give them, various things that'll cause gas and cause their body to explode. Well, you know, interesting enough, most ants are liquid feeders. And so, as I said, you know, did they have an aversion or repellency? Possibly. Did something else happen? It's hard to say. But unfortunately, when people have tried the trials to see if this works, they've not been able to duplicate that.
Well, so it sounds like, Lucille, you just got lucky that your ants moved away. So glad to hear it. Let's go to Bob in Dubuque, Iowa next. Hi, Bob.
Hello.
Hi.
How we doing?
Good.
Good. I have a what looks like a bite on my knuckle. It's just a little bit, the red spot is just a little bit smaller than a dime. And then on the inside, there's just like a white part that looks almost like a blister. It's not a blister, but it does feel like I burned myself, but I didn't burn myself.
Hmm. What do you think, Phil?
Well, I mean, bites are always, I don't know anybody that I trust, doctor, entomologist, that can diagnose a bite by its appearance alone.
Hmm.
You can have suspicions. And, you know, the problem with it is that oftentimes, even if it was a bite originally, the complications are usually more bacterial. And so if it continues to bother you, I think I'd go see somebody, as I said, to prevent a bacterial infection, which can be far more serious. Now, some spider bites do blister. Because of the venom that's associated with it. So you can't say it was not that. But just because you have a blister-like and a reaction underneath it, as I said, one could guess, but that's what it is a guess. And what my bigger concern would be is to make sure that we don't get an infection in that site, which, again, could become more systemic and much more serious.
All right. Well, good luck with that bite, Bob. And we had Paul from Madison call in. He wanted to know, is the praying mantis native to Wisconsin? He didn't think so, but he saw one in Madison.
Yes, but this is a fun story because there are no native mantids to Wisconsin. The mantid that I have seen most often recently is called the Chinese mantid, and it's an imported species that you could buy their egg cases or Oatheca in garden catalogs and bring them in the spring. But the story always has been historically is that they overwinter as these egg cases and they would freeze out. Well, not anymore. I mean, this is something we know. We've got breeding populations in the southern part of the state and in Door County. And this has been going on for a while. I saw a mantid when I was watching a Brewers game in Milwaukee. I saw a mantid when I went to the Wisconsin football games. My neighbor brought me a mantid.
So they're sports fans is what you're saying.
Yes. and so we do have established populations now in that they will become somewhat more commonplace. And so it's kind of fun to watch. And as I said, everything I've seen so far has been the Chinese mantid. There's also a European mantid that potentially could be showing up here too. It's a very similar story. And they look very similar. There's just a spot on the leg of the European mantid that we use to identify it.
Great. And also we had an email from Robert that says, frequently when turning over the garden in spring during dusk, I come across grub-like insects that have a distinct glow. Are these firefly larvae? The grub appear to be fairly large to end up as fireflies.
Two possibilities. It could be firefly, and there's a related species called the glowworms. And what's interesting about the glowworms, it's not the adult stage that does the glowing per se. Although it's a little more complicated than that. The females of the glowworms are larva form, meaning they never transform into adult beetles. They stay in the larval stage.
Hmm.
And just like fireflies, it has to do with mating. So it could be immature fireflies. They have a glow to them, but it could also be glowworms. And I see more glowworms coming in. In both cases, they're predators. Predators either on snails or millipedes.
There you go. So our friend in Cross Plains needs to get a whole lot of fireflies.
And so they're good guys. And you would expect them to be down in the leaf litter and under rocks and the like. And as I said, so look up glowworm. The other thing you'll find out, the males are the most bizarre looking thing. They don't even look like beetles. They've got these big feather antennae. I'll be honest, it's one of those classic insects that we would often like to bring into a master's thesis exam and see if the student could identify it, because it's not your typical insect.
Because you're just mean that way.
Well, it happened to me, so. But, yeah.
All right. Well, Chris Molina, our honor producer, put up a photo here that Sally sent in. Whoops, let me get back to the right one. She found it on a basil leaf, and it's a very armored looking
insect. Oh, it's
insect.
A bizarre looking thing. And honestly, if you touch it, sometimes these arm-like structures come off. It turns out to be something we would call a hag moth caterpillar. Now, I wouldn't expect them to feed on basil. I see hag moth caterpillars feeding on maple, among others. Another name that they're given is monkey slug. I never quite figured out where that came from, but that's another common name associated with them. And the adult is nothing special, but the larvae is a very interesting thing because it has these long, fuzzy projections off the body. And even if you turn them over, it doesn't have the characteristic legs, but that's characteristic of the slug caterpillars. They're all kind of interesting-looking creatures. And there are some slug caterpillars that have urticating hairs on their body, like stinging nettle, but not this species.
And Stacy also posted a photo on the Facebook page of a caterpillar. It says, I found these in North Dakota last September. They were on vines growing on a deck. What kind of caterpillar are they? Do we have them in Wisconsin? They were green and brown ones. When disturbed, they would raise their heads and dance back and forth. They were very large.
Yeah, it's definitely a hornworm. I just can't quite get, it looks like tomato hornworm, but depending on the vine, especially with the brown color too, it could even be Pandora's sphinx, although I'm not, as I said, I can't see it. But we have a number of species of hornworms, and what hornworms do is they get as big as 3 to 4 inches long. Most species will burrow in the ground and do their transformation, and that's how they get through the winter as the pupal stage in the ground, and then the adult hawk moths or sphinx moths come out the next spring. So we do have species here, and that behavior you have is one that they use to try to keep fly parasites away.
Oh.
The flies like to lay their eggs right behind the head of the caterpillar, and then the maggots will burrow in and kill the caterpillar. So this is a natural control that goes on. And as they said, this swinging their head back and forth is a way to try to discourage the fly. It usually doesn't work, but,
but
nice try.
But they're giving it a good try. All right. Well, thanks for those photos and questions. Let's go to Katie in McFarland on the phones next. Hi, Katie.
Hi, Phil. Thanks for taking my call. I have a, I'm pretty sure it's a barn spider that lives in my dining room under my wallpaper, and I've kind of gotten attached to it, and I was just wondering, during the winter, what will become of the spider? I'm sure there's no food available.
Sure. The strategy, if it's a barn spider, which is an orb weaver spider, is most of those species, in fact, all that I'm aware of, overwinter as eggs. So she, if she's mated, she will have laid an egg sac, and then her little baby spiders will hatch next spring, but she will not survive. And that's just the norm for barn spiders. And one would think that in the house, they probably could survive a little bit longer because of the warmer temperatures, but they're eventually going to starve to death. And as I said, they're just not biologically set up to spend the winter. Even if you were feeding her crickets all the time, they often will die by early December or January at the very latest, has been my experience.
When do the babies come out?
Typically in the spring, and they're very tiny little spiders, and they go running away. I mean, orb weaver spiders are not typically considered indoor spiders. They're things that would more typically live out in the shrubbery. Takes them all summer to develop into the adults. We often don't see or recognize they're out there until the late summer and early fall.
Thanks for that call, Katie. And Stephen in Waukesha has a question. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
See, I collected this ant species, I believe it is. Occasionally, we live in a five-acre woods area, and occasionally we have encountered some large black ants inside the house. And they come and go, but I don't know, our house is all insulated concrete except for the roof structure, so I wasn't really too worried about carpenter ants yet. But last week, I found this large one. It has the body of a normal ant, which are about a half inch long and black, but this one has a abdomen on the back that is at least an inch long, 3/8 of an inch in diameter, and it's tapered at the very end, and I was wondering if that's a queen or something of the the carpenter ant species or something like that.
No, in fact, in the back of my mind, I'm wondering if it's an ant. There's a couple blister beetle species that have these very long abdomens that look very ant-like but are not. Queen carpenter ants are just wing carpenter ants. And one of the things you could tell, at least if it was, after they mate, they will rip their wings off, but there's still wing stubs there. So true ants will have the little wing stubs on the thorax. True ants also will have this incredible constriction between the abdomen and the the thorax, although sometimes this is kind of hidden just the way they're attached, but all ants have that constriction. One of the other characteristics of ant species is they have elbowed antennae, so it comes out like an L. If you still got the critter, you could take a picture and send it to me. But as I said, I've had a number of times people send me blister beetles that have very distended abdomens. And some of the blister beetle species look so similar, and they're not hard like a normal beetle. They're soft. And I'm more inclined to think that's what you've got.
All right. Well, thanks for that question, Stephen. And let's go back to the phones to Mark in Colgate. Hi, Mark.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
Hey, Phil, I got a problem in my basement. I've had these little white crawling things for the last 4 weeks. They look, if you take a sewing needle, half the size of a sewing needle, and they're white, and they crawl like worms. Would you guesstimate that that could be a maggot of some kind?
That's the first place I'd go.
Okay.
But there's also some little caterpillars I get out of dog food and whatnot that would be similar. The difference would be is if they have a defined head, and you may need a microscope for that, but the caterpillar would have a little round brown head. Maggots, interesting enough, they have little mouth hooks, but they don't have heads. Depending on the family of flies it is, most species of maggots are kind of tapered on the front end and then more blunt on the back, and they have what most people would read as eyes, but they're really a type of breathing spiracle on it. So if you got maggots, you know, typically we associate it with dead animals, more often than not, and you do find cases where the dead mouse or whatnot is sitting up in the sill plate, and the maggots are falling down onto the floor. So, if it's a small food source, it will just run its course by itself. You just clean up the maggots, you're done. It was a bigger food source, I think the odor would have caught your attention. You'd tell something just doesn't smell quite right. So, without that as a background, as I said, it may be something that just will self resolve itself.
Said an odor. A couple of weeks ago, there was a strong odor, and we checked for mice, moved everything around in the basement, didn't find any dead mice.
Yeah, we'll see if something dies in the wall void or a chipmunk, something like that. You know, it'll be hard to get to, but it isn't unusual. And I get this case quite a bit. It's either the maggots fall down through a light fixture or they come out from an electrical plate onto the kitchen floor, you know, and people are looking for the source out in their living space. But as they said, the source could be somewhere else. But if the odors kind of went away, and this is probably what helped the odor go away because they've helped to digest that protein and whatnot. So,
all right, thanks for that call, Mark. And let's go to Lori in Buffalo, Minnesota. Hi, Lori.
Well, hi there. I've got what I think are called digger bees on my. We live on a lake and we have a beach. And 3 years ago, there was like 50 of them, and they were kind of cute. You see them digging the sand, and they hover, like, between 10 and 2 in the afternoon. They'll hover and kind of cruise around. The next year, there had to be over 200, and this year we had at least over 500. Frightening.
Okay. Some of those species are even stingless, and honestly, they are very non-aggressive. They might look aggressive, but there are no true nests. These are what we call solitary bees, or there's a small chance it's a solitary wasp. But in either case, there's no true nest. There's no true colony, which means there's nothing to defend. If you had to do something, two thoughts. One of them, because they're probably digging a burrow, providing it with whatever the suitable food is for their young, laying their eggs, and so they're developing here. So that's why you're building a colony. So literally going in and tilling the soil and exposing this stuff would kill the developing bees. So that's one option. The other option is a little bit more, if you've got 200 little holes, you're going to have to fill every one, or not fill, but dust every one of those little holes with a garden dust. And when the bees come and go, that will kill them. But those are the only two solutions I can think of other than just tolerating them.
Well, I'm picturing like 2,000 next year. What's garden dust? Is there an insecticide name for that?
Well, yeah, I mean, the most common garden dust you'll see is a product called Seven, S-E-V-I-N. So it's a very common dust. You can get almost any hardware store, and you don't need very much of it. Where dust work so much better for things in the ground is that a spray honestly gets intercepted and soaked up by the soil. The dust sits there, and when they come and go. And one of the interesting things about Seven, it is very toxic to bees. I mean, that's one of its negative side effects. And so that's why we use it for controlling wasps and stuff in ground nests and for this type of thing. And you don't have to be there. You just treat it. And when they come and go, they will take care of themselves.
Good luck with that, Lori. And Phil, we had an email asking about, let's see, where are we at with gypsy moths?
You know, interesting, if you looked at the records from last year, and Department of Ag has just published their records, is that in 2010, we had the record amount of defoliation in the state. It was like 300,000 acres that were defoliated, but the populations crashed. This year, things have been very, very quiet. I mean, I didn't hear of any defoliation. There was no records of any you know, three-acre plots being stripped. But at the end of the year, when they evaluated their moth catches, they're up like 20-30%. I don't remember the exact number. What we hope for is much like what caused the population to crash, really the last 2 years to some degree, is some of the fungal diseases. What the fungal diseases need is a wet spring, especially in late March and early April. So I don't see anything. You know, Department of Ag will go into the hot spots and look for egg surveys. Those will be a better assessment of where we're sitting with numbers. But I guess I would be surprised if there's any of anything. I would see a reduced amount of acreage that needs to be treated. And as I said, if we can get a break with the weather in the spring, they'll stay light.
Thanks so much, Phil. And we are out of time, but you will be back on December 21st, so we can mark our calendars for that.
Sounds good.
And stay tuned here on the Ideas Network.